Hello, this is international football commentator Derek Ray, and you're listening to the Ranks FC podcast.
Hello, Rank Squad, and welcome to Ranks FC. It's your favourite transatlantic podcast. A little bit of a change of schedule to a degree this week. This is an extract from our post box that we did over on the Patreon, where we walked through the World Cup final, the questions that our Rank Squad gave us, the ultras gave us to get through. We've talked about Spain, Argentina, a little bit of England, and some general World Cup stuff as well. My name is Jack Collins, and I'll be your host today. And joining me across the wall, all the way from San Diego, is Mr. Dean Jones. How you doing, mate?
Hello, mate.
It's all lots of fun. We've got lots of questions to get stuck into. So without further ado, let's get on with it. PB says, what a tournament. Just complete domination from Spain in every single knockout match. 2 months ago, if you said this Spain team with a defense of Pedro Porro, Pau Cabarsi, Aymeric Laporte, and Marc Cucurella with Unai Simón in goal would achieve the most dominant defensive performance in World Cup history, you would have been called a madman. But that's exactly what they did. They concede one goal. They allow only 11 shots on target in 8 games and barely allowed any chances at all to either the vaunted French attack or the defending champions led by the GOAT. And it all starts from the midfield. Rodri, Dani Olmo and Fabian Ruiz are strong enough, but to be able to bring Pedri, Mikel Merino and Martin Zubimendi off the bench, how are you going to score if you can barely touch the ball? And when you do get the ball, they take it off you before you can do anything with it. Lamine and Nico weren't fully healthy, but even at 70-80%, they caused havoc. Imagine what might have happened if they weren't dealing with injuries. And that's probably the scariest part. This team can easily be better than what they already are. And finally, a shout out to Ferran Torres. I've deeply apologize for all the times I've slandered him. Keep him, Deco. Give him the contract he wants. I gotta say, like, there's lots of points here that are gonna kind of, we're gonna get to over a couple of different questions, but I think that PB might be the only man that brings up Ferran Torres, and it is a nice place to start. I tweeted this last night, delighted for Ferran Torres, because a much maligned footballer at times in his career. He's always kind of felt like he wasn't quite sure if he was a nine or a winger, and there's those at Barcelona who aren't completely sure about where he's at and what he can do. He will forever be a man that won Spain a World Cup now, and I was absolutely delighted for him.
Mate, as soon as he came on the pitch, I said to the kids, he'll score a goal. Like, Ferran is so good at coming up with well-timed moments, and he's a great, great player to have in the squad. And I mean, look, Spain's substitutions and the depth of their squad shone generally, I think, as that second half played on and then we got to extra time. But yeah, it was the addition of Ferran that I always had. I took quite a lot of comfort in that substitution, and, you know, the manner of the goal and the way that the strike is so controlled. He's managing to keep his body slightly over it while still managing to steer it in with kind of the top side of his foot into the roof of the net. It's brilliant. Also brilliant from Nico Williams, by the way, to veer that back into his path in the way that he did. I mean, Nico did obviously mess up an unbelievable opportunity to make it 2-0, which I still haven't recovered from totally. But nevertheless, yeah, Ferran is class, mate. And I think that he is the sort of player that genuinely every single top team wants. Like, whether it's Barcelona, whether it would be Man City, whether it be PSG, Bayern Munich, like, he is somebody that all of those teams should be like, yeah, we'll take him. Because he will just do a job. And not just do a job, do it very effectively in moments like that. No surprise to me at all.
Yeah, I mean, look, a very special moment for him, but also just reward, I think, for a very hard-working performance over the course of the tournament, where he hadn't necessarily got the just rewards that, you know, maybe he should have done. He'd been putting himself in good positions, he'd be getting on the end of things. And, you know, it's funny, someone brought up on the radio today, if Ferran had just scored from that first chance against Cap Verde where he hits the bar, Spain would have had a perfect tournament. And my response was, well, he's made up for it, isn't he?
Yeah.
It's not the end of the world. I'm not that worried about that performance anymore. He'd be more worried about who's going to sit the ball in the back of the net in a World Cup final.
Yeah.
And turns out it was Ferran. He will always have that mythical status now. Like, even like Mario Götze, right? Never quite got to the level we perhaps expected him to get to, but will forever retain mythical status because of what he did in this tournament. No, I, for what it's worth, I agree. I think he's also less, has less of a proclivity to get injured. But I do think that when you kind of look at it, you know, scoring the winner in a World Cup final is something no one will ever take away from you.
Oh, of course. Yeah. It's great. And I like as well that it was someone a bit less predictable. It wasn't Messi. It wasn't Lamine. It was somebody that people have got to discover a bit more about.
Right. Let's go on to a bunch of other questions. Zach Herman says, this is a well-deserved World Cup win for Spain. It's an embarrassment of riches they have in their team. To be able to bring on Pedri and Ferran in the 60th minute, followed by Marino and Nico Williams in the 75th minute is absurd. It's tough for Argentina, or any team for that matter, to be able to match that. Also, is Rodri now officially the best defensive midfielder of all time? Comprehensive performances every game this tournament, even after coming back from injury and barely playing for City this season. He oozes class on the pitch. So well deserved, being player of the tournament. And lastly, shout out to Kubasi. As a Barcelona fan whose favourite player of all time is Carlos Puyol, Kubasi is shooting up my list very quickly. I'm so happy he received the Young Player of the Tournament award, and everyone was able to see how amazing he is. Mad to think he's only 19 years old. And actually, on that note, we've got two other messages on each of those players. Tyler DeSando saying, I've not got much to add that others haven't said already, but I think we do need to talk about how generational Rodri is. Also, I can't see Spain slowing down at all. And Jacob Connell said, Pau Kubasi, take a bow. He played like the best centre-back in the world in this tournament. Just goes to show you how challenging it is to play in Hansi Flick's system as a centre-back. Is there any reason that Kubasi can't become the best centre-back ever? He's a teenager with a ridiculous collection of trophies already and the performances to back them up. So the only point I would make to Rodri being a well-deserved player of the tournament is, I don't care that Pau Kubasi got Young Player of the Tournament. I would have given him the lot.
Oh, I don't know. Rodri needed his flowers for that World Cup, for the way he's commanded it. Is he the best DM ever? I don't even know if he's the best Spain DM ever, because I'd say Busquets would have something to say about that. I mean, when you take in longevity, when you take in the level of the teams that he was playing in, like, Busquets is definitely in that conversation. And then obviously once you start opening that out, there's the whole Makélélé conversation to be had, and Kanté would come into it, and then maybe you even go further and go Vieira and Keane and all of that stuff. So I don't know if Rodri's the best, but he's so well controlled in this tournament. Unbelievable from him and from Spain. Just like the way that they set out was they played a whole tournament in the style that they wanted, which is so hard to carry out. They didn't become emotive, and that is absolutely fair play to all of them. I'll be surprised if nobody tries to sign Rodri from Man City this summer. He's got a year. His contract's winding down, and Real Madrid say they're not going to offer. They've kind of held off and stuff. I don't know. I'm still not totally convinced. It doesn't seem like a new contract at City's on the table. And on the back of this, maybe something happens there. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I'd be surprised if there isn't a new contract from City being thought about, at the very least, considering the performances this season.
I think it's thought about. I just don't think he's signing it, to be honest.
Fair. I mean, shouts out to Pep Guardiola as well. Back in October, he was asked when we see the best version of Rodri again. He was like, no, he's working his way back. Rodri will be back for the World Cup, and he'll be back to his best for the World Cup. Turns out Pep Guardiola knows a thing or two about football. He also said Rodri would be absolutely majestic in this next season for Manchester City. So we'll see how it goes. But I tend to trust him on matters like this. And look, this is it. Like in terms of Kubasi, what he's won already, you know, the way he dominated this tournament from a numbers perspective, what was it, most completed passes, most successful, highest pass rate, like most interceptions. He had just had a phenomenal tournament. The line-breaking passes, all of it put together, a sensational footballer. And I can't wait to see him continue to develop. But you don't see these players as centre-back at 19 years old, Dean. And I think this is the interesting thing about Kubasi. You know, he plays like someone who's twice his age in terms of the maturity. He's not the biggest player in the world. He's not the most athletic footballer in the world, but he reads the game to a degree that almost no one else does. And he's the same age pretty much as Lamine Yamal. Obviously, Lamine is an attacking player, so therefore he's going to kind of pick up more of the plaudits for goals and assists and all of those things. But in terms of where they play and comparatively from their positions, Kubasi has every bit as much a young superstar.
Oh, 100%, yeah. Unbelievable the level he's playing at. Such a young age as well. I mean, that's what makes Spain so scary is that they're not really coming to the end of any cycles, like in terms of like how this team would slow down over the coming tournaments. Whereas obviously like Argentina have to think about Messi, like England have to think about Kane, France can continue to be pretty consistent, but Spain look like they might only get better because of like the age and stage of so many of their team. So yeah, I think Kubasi fits in perfectly with that.
In terms of that, and then look, to just talk about Spain's future a little bit more, I did a thing today on the radio where I wrote these down, so I've already got this to hand. But if you look at this squad, right, the players in the squad this time round, 19 years old, Lamine Yamal, Pau Kubasi, 21 years old, Gavi, 23 years old, Marc Pubil, Pedri, Jeremy Pino, and new Liverpool signing Victor Munoz. Nico Williams is 24, and then at 25, they've got Joan Garcia, Alex Baena, and Eric Garcia as well. Then you look at the players who weren't in the squad, either because they haven't got there yet, they've been playing in the youth systems, or they were injured. And it gets even scarier. 18 years old, Thiago Pitarque, who played 16 times for Real Madrid over the course of this season and looks every inch the kind of Spanish midfielder. 19, you got Marc Bernal, Hector Fort. 20, you got John Martin, who's been absolutely brilliant for Real Sociedad. Jesus Rodriguez, who left Betis very young to go to Como, has been part of that project. Dean Huijsen is 21 years old. Christian Mosquera, Arsenal, is 22 years old. Samu Agahawa, who I think is going to be the next number nine at Porto, 22 years old. Also Marc Casado and Alex Balde. Then at 23, you've got Fermin Lopez, who was injured, otherwise would have been in this squad. Pablo Barrios, who looks like he could be the heart of the midfield for Atleti for the next decade. And Real Madrid's left back, Alvaro Carreras. Like, the depth here is absolutely flabbergasting. And I know you can point to the same for France, right? And I do think it's always worth pointing that out. But just the way that these squads seem to come in and fit so seamlessly into what Spain want to do, and that they're already playing in this kind of style at youth level, and they're just going to be brought through into these first teams. Not all of those are going to make it, let's be very clear. Like, they don't all naturally just fit in, and not every single one of them is going to go on and be a superstar. But the amount of talent that's already playing either at top clubs or is competing in Europe or have already kind of started to make serious waves for their clubs at 21, 22 years old, is staggering and pretty frightening, I think, as well.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, we kind of could have predicted this anyway, but obviously Spain are already set as favourites to win the next World Cup. It's going to be on home soil as well, which helps. But given the fact that they have that squad you've just listed, they are now the reigning champions of Europe and the world, and they host the next World Cup and might even be better by then, is pretty frightening. And I think France are the only team you can guarantee-ish that are at that same level by the time we get to 2030. Obviously, Argentina and the Messi thing, Kane thing for England. And like, there's, for a lot of the other teams, there's just like, even Portugal, I know they're one of the hosts too, but like, no Ronaldo. Yes, we assume that means that they might actually become more of a team and progress, but you're still losing Ronaldo. So not necessarily does that make you better, and you've still got to actually find a boss that can bring it all together, which they failed to do with all of their golden generations and stuff. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see how that one turns around.
Let's flip over to the Argentina side of it. And there was a lot of comments here. And as you can imagine, Dean, a lot of them banging on the same kind of drum. So I'm going to rattle through these first ones to begin with. Finn Jupner said, "The first Argentina game I've seen reffed fairly. And even then, Paredes was lucky to stay on the field. But that aside, the best team at the tournament won the whole thing, and that's rare. I know that they won the last two major tournaments, but it still feels like Spain's era of domination is just beginning. Also, hot take, Argentina get grouped in the next World Cup. They'll have to turn over the entire team, and that never goes well." I want to come, we've got a question later on the actual point of, you know, where do Argentina go from here, which I think is really interesting. But let's just get into the questions that are a little bit, let's say, angrier about some of the tactics that Argentina have employed in this World Cup. So Eddie Wright says, "I'll keep my question pretty simple for the two of you to answer. I'm curious to know your thoughts. Would you want to win a World Cup using the tactics that Argentina have this tournament? Jack, you explained to us all that the Argentinians have a word that they use to call the dark arts." Yeah, viveza criollo or criolla, depending on where you are. It means native cunning, effectively, in many ways. He says, "They can call it whatever they want, but in my opinion, it's cheap. cheating and it's disgraceful. I'd rather lose than win how they have. I was brought up to show some respect to my opponents and play with good sportsmanship no matter how much you want to win. By the end of this tournament, I really started to hate this team, and not just because they beat England, because we deserve to lose, but because of their behaviour on the pitch. The scenes at full time just compound what we'd already seen on the pitch throughout the tournament and ended with the rest of the world supporting Spain, so I'm glad they won it. As a great man once said, would you rather die a hero or live long enough to see yourself become the villain? Just on that, and we'll get into the, because the dark arts and all of those elements, we'll get into them in a second. If England won the World Cup doing that, would you be all right with it?
Yep.
Yeah, I thought that would be the answer.
Well, mate, like we've got to, if we, like, you still won it. Like, at this rate we're going, we're never going to win it. So I'll just take whichever means it comes. Like, half of the stuff is okay. I'm okay. I'm not okay with, like, Paredes at full time yesterday.
No, I'm with you.
Like, so that oversteps the mark for me. And I think if I'm seeing England players do that after we lose a final, then it's like, it, you know, as I saw people saying, like, they've showed more attack there than they've showed in the entire game. And it's like, yeah, exactly. Like, where was this? When the ball was at your feet. But in terms of the other, you know, leaving one in on people, it's a bit old-fashioned English, to be honest. So, like, I can't say that I'm totally against that. And given that we've tried to modernize our football, we've got good at it. Like, we are very good at football now with the teams that we have. We're still lacking something. So if what it genuinely took was we spend a tournament with the rest of the world hating us because we were leaving our studs on someone, so be it, mate. I mean,
I thought this would be your answer.
I don't know how long I've got left alive. I want to see it in the World Cup.
I would have been shocked if you said no to that, for what it's worth. So yeah. Anyway, let's get on to this main topic because everyone has an opinion. Hamza Effendi says, was that maybe the worst all-round showing for our team in any final in recent history? Argentina were poor on the field and sports off it. They don't deserve all the airtime they'll get on the basis of yesterday's performance and antics, and they won't care either. But to see the final reduced to one side not really bothering to attempt to play was disappointing. Such tactics made me respect Spain even more. To stay composed throughout and focusing only on your own game is a testament to elite mentality and an unshakable belief in their methods of a different variety to the Argentines. They played some wonderful stuff when they were allowed to, and the eventual winning goal felt euphoric. On the balance of things, the best team usually tends to win out at the World Cup, and this year it was no different. What a tournament indeed. Cody Fielden said, Argentina will go down as one of the most embarrassing group of players in World Cup histories. The diving, the fighting, the antics, and above all, them being protected throughout. There was no greater satisfaction than seeing their tears at full time. Brant Cole said what you said there before. Pretty sure if the Argentines had attacked the Spanish goal the way they attacked the Spanish players after the whistle, they'd have a better chance in that game. I mean this with all respect to the Argentines in the rank squad, but thank God they lost. A bunch of clowns who can give it, but as soon as it goes against them, they lash out. And Enzo getting sent off was chef's kiss. Ethan Alberson has a slightly different view on it, so I'll get to that one in a second. But Akshant said, what a shameful showing from Argentina. No shots in 90 minutes. More red cards than shots on target. And to top it all off, Paredes threw more punches at Gavi than Argentina did at Spain in the whole game. A disgraceful performance, and it's fitting that Enzo got sent off. TJ Fogarty saying, it's crazy that the guy who plays for Red Card FC got a red card and cost his team the match. To which Darius replied, for its worth, to be fair, it's not like Argentina were in the game before that. Zero shots in the 92 minutes before the red. It's pathetic, and it's because the team is nothing but pass to Messi and OP scores. The game should have been 3-0 minimum before the red. And then Tommy Askew said, how on earth Paredes finished his game on the pitch? I have no idea. Football won tonight and Argentina was shown that with a serious team in front of them, they had no ideas. They had no place being in this final with such a mediocre team. Do you not think they were protected in different circumstances throughout the World Cup and were somewhat helped? Look, we have slightly different views on this, I think, in terms of the decisions. We obviously discussed it after the Egypt game, that, you know, whilst the decisions were fundamentally correct, I think that other teams have not got them. I have no real issue with the Mbolo red card. I think it's unfortunate in the fact that, you know, if the ref hadn't booked Paredes, which interestingly is what people were arguing, that Argentina never get booked. And the one time they did get booked, it ended up being incorrect and, you know, then overtaken. And
unfortunately, Mbolo does deserve that one, yeah.
Yeah, it's just like one of those calls, like, it's unfortunate it hasn't happened to any other teams.
But, it was mad, mate. That was what was crazy about the tournament. Everything went, they got all the decisions, like even the ones that were like wrong at first turned out to be right. Like even that Spain first goal yesterday where he's like trod on his toe first, I was like, no, that's no way that could be a foul. And you're like, oh my God, it actually is a foul. But like, And then everyone's like, hang on, what about when this happened to England or Messi on Jed Spence or whatever? And you're like, yeah,
this
but.
Is the point I was going to bring up, though, the Messi on Jed Spence thing, because this, I think, is where the World Cup has got out of hand in terms of social media now. So Messi doesn't touch Jed Spence, right? Like, there's no contact. And someone has changed the image online and it's being circulated on Twitter. With like, look, there's two things here. One, Jed Spence was like, I got cramp. He spoke about it. And two, the other thing was that if he had been stood on, he wouldn't have gone hopping on that leg. Like, it's impossible to hop on a leg you've just been stood on. Like, that's not the way that you naturally would react. But I think that, I think there is a case to be made that you can be like, Argentina got lucky with a couple of decisions that went their way. Right, like I absolutely agree with that, and I think you can look at something like the forearm that goes into the back of Elliot Anderson early doors in the England game, etc. And you can complain that these decisions haven't been looked at in the same kind of way. Fine. The problem is that now there's loads of stuff that actually didn't happen being like doctored online. People being like, "Yeah, Messi's offside with the first England goal," and got loads of messages about this on the radio. I was like, "Yeah, the reason that it wasn't called back for offside is because." He wasn't offside. Like, and then they're like, show me an image. I'm like, that's not real. That's not the image. Yeah. I can see the image in front of me. And I think that we've got into this kind of death spiral. No, this isn't to excuse any of the behavior from Argentina yesterday. It was disgraceful after the whistle. I am the last person that's going to sit here and say that that's acceptable. And I think they have got lucky on a couple of different calls. But the problem is that this has been spun into this kind of grand conspiracy online that therefore is slightly different to actually what the reality of the situation is. And it means it's very hard to have this discussion in any sort of sensible manner.
No, you're right. Yeah, that's a fair point that you make for sure. And that is the, you know, we are entering very dangerous territory now, not just with social media, but with AI, with everyone becoming more familiar with editing tools and all the rest of it. Like, we have to be so careful about what we're actually looking at and knowing whether it's real or not. It's become a really hard part of our job as people that analyze it as well, because, you know, I'll be sent tweets or I'll, you know, and if I'm writing stories and news and reacting to things, it's like, oh, I don't know if this is real. Like, you've really got to, if there's any element of doubt, you've really got to check it. And that Messi Spence thing is a very good example of that. But yeah, look, Argentina, they did get a lot of things, go their way, but some of it, this is what was so frustrating about it. Like, sometimes it was fair that decisions were overturned, but it was, the fact was that for other teams they felt we weren't getting those overturns. But
absolutely,
it's just very, very convoluted.
It's a funny one. And I do think they got the rub of the green, right? Like, absolutely no doubt about that. And look, it is probably worth talking about what happened after the game, because those scenes are disgraceful. Like, look, we don't know what was said and what was discussed between them, but it didn't look like there was loads of things going on. And then suddenly there was fistfights breaking out everywhere. And it's just like, at the end of it, you know, seeing that team turn around. Look, I think them appreciating their fan base is absolutely fine. Don't do it in the middle of the trophy celebration, right? Don't do it whilst the trophy lift is happening. There's some basics here. And actually, a bit of respect here for Lionel Scaloni, who came out afterwards and was like, we are good. We were excellent when we won. We need to be better at losing. Like, we lost badly today. We did not, you know, appreciate the severity of the situation. And we, you know, we will look bad. And that's something that's going to be counted against us. And I thought it was a very brave thing to come out and say at that moment in time.
Yeah, it was obviously very emotional after the game as well, and tearful. But yeah, you know, obviously we've seen Barco against England, and now we've seen Paredes against Spain. Look, I'm all for winding people up. Don't get me wrong. Like, I love it when people wind people up on football pitches. I used to do it. I used to like getting reactions out of people and seeing if it affected the way that they would play. Barco overstepped the mark for me because he's in the middle of the pitch and he's a sub. Like,
yeah, get off the pitch.
I just cannot believe still in this moment they ran that far on the pitch. And like, and then afterwards he's on again and like, I don't know, like, I'm surprised Bellingham didn't hit him harder, to be honest. Like, he was just been so annoyed with the lad. And obviously Barco is joining Chelsea. So that's interesting. Like, Chelsea already have Enzo Fernandez. They're waiting to
imagine
announce
the reception he's going to get at Stamford Bridge on the first day of the season.
Like, every Chelsea fan I know hates Enzo Fernandez. Like, and like that goes for match going ones that I know have season tickets. That goes for casual ones. That goes for my mate out here who I watch the game with, who's calling Enzo a rat throughout the game and stuff, and like hates him. They do not want him playing for their football club. And now they're also signing Barco from Strasbourg, their parent club. I mean, as I say, we're still waiting for official news on it. But I've even heard today, like, there's a link to Christian Romero and Chelsea. So it's like, surely Chelsea aren't going to go down this route. There's enough people that don't like him already. Like, don't give him so much reason that even their own fan base aren't going to like him. But this is where the disparity comes in, and what I do find acceptable and I don't find acceptable. Yes, I'm happy for England to win by testing the boundaries and putting in a few late challenges and stuff. But do I want to see him doing what like Romero and Barco and Paredes have been doing away from the ball? Nah, I don't really, mate. I think that is actually where I draw the line.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think you would accept it if you won the World Cup, but you wouldn't necessarily be pleased about it. I imagine there's an element of that with all of the you know, with some of the Argentine support as well, who are like...
Well, I don't have a problem with it because of the example it sets to, like, my kids watching as well. Like, that would be my deeper problem with it now as a parent. It's like, I see Dylan and Reese becoming absolutely obsessed with these players and like literally within minutes of these games, like mimicking what they've seen. And it's so interesting to see, particularly Reese. Like he does a lot of this anyway in his life. Like he'll go to one baseball game and suddenly he wants to look like Tatis. And he's suddenly got like a headband in and he wants braids and he wants the full Padres kit. Or then he'll suddenly go to school and his teacher will be wearing, I don't know, a dress. And he's like, I want to wear a dress. Like wherever he goes, he likes to mimic people. And it happens the most when he watches football. And so if I was to see that negative behavior was coming into my kids, then I would have, massive issues with it.
Yeah, no, I think that's fair. And look, I think that the mark was fundamentally overstepped at points in this tournament, but notably, I think, after the final there. But equally, you know, we talk about a World Cup and wanting it to represent, you know, I came on here and went to bat for Paraguay after that game against France, right? Because I was like, well, obviously they were going to test the limits up to where the referee was going to punish them because that was their best chance of winning the game. And then, you know, thus it proved they didn't win the game. But a lot of people are like, it's a disgrace. But, you know, there are different ways of playing the game and refs are different in South America than they are in Europe in the same way that they're different in North America and they're different in Africa and Asia. Like there are different ways that the game is played. And when the world comes together for a World Cup, I think sometimes we have a particularly kind of Europhilic way of looking at the game. It's like, well, if it's not done this way, then that's not it. But I don't know if that's always true. And I think that there are different elements of it and different ways of playing it that are sometimes kind of brought to light in these World Cups and in these tournaments to pit different, you know, organizations or nations around the world against each other. It is worth pointing out that the game is played differently elsewhere. And sometimes what is a foul one place isn't a foul somewhere else. And the way that you go about your footballing life, you know, I've been lucky enough to be in South America earlier in this year. And the obsession, that burning passion with which football is held gives you a different kind of sense of, you know, how much it means and, you know, what it means to kind of go on there and be able to put it all on the line for your team. And sometimes the mark is naturally going to be overstepped in those situations. So I think it's always worth putting in the context. That doesn't mean that I can condone what happened after the full-time whistle in the same way, right? Like both things can be true at once.
From a footballing perspective, I know we started that section with questions with someone saying, you know, is this, and if they call it the most embarrassing or one-sided affair or something like that, you obviously are having no shots. Then immediately I thought, well, it's like hugely one-sided finals in recent times. Like, oh yeah, like Champions League, PSG beat Inter Milan 5-0, right? And I was like, what was that? What did that look like? Inter Milan had 10 shots. Like, only two of them were on target, but they had 8 off target. And the possession was 59-41. It's like, even in a game that was like completely lopsided like that in a final, didn't kind of feel as bad as this. It's straight. And even again, like I thought, well, England played Spain a couple of years ago in the Euros and it was a close in terms of scoreline. We lost the game.
Well, this was 2-1. Close in terms of scoreline, but it wasn't close in terms of the game at hand.
No, it wasn't, but it wasn't close. So I was like, I wonder what the stats were in terms of how many shots England had compared to Spain. England had 9 shots in that game. Mm. I was like, okay. I like, that doesn't reflect too badly. Like, Spain had 15 shots. We had 9. Like, take that, because I remember the game feeling we didn't deserve anything from it and didn't feel that bad about losing it afterwards. So, yeah, I think that probably puts into perspective just how crazily one-sided this one was.
Yeah, I mean, look, I would say, you know, to that point, we spent, you know, 30 minutes of this podcast talking about how good Spain were. And I think it's testament to, you know, how impressive they were in terms of the way that they set up that defensive unit that's conceded 1 goal all tournament. What do we say? It was 11 shots on target they've conceded in 11 goal in 8 games. Emi Martinez made 11 saves in this game on his own. So that speaks to how good Spain have been defensively and the way that the midfield worked to actually block those avenues. Messi completely isolated. They didn't have that split striker thing that they had going on against England, so they couldn't find those moves out wide and push them in those areas. It just felt like a really difficult game that they never got a handle on. All right, let's move onwards. We've got some other questions to kind of round this up. So I like this from Ethan Zarezny, who says, so now that we've finished another amazing summer of football, what is this tournament going to be remembered for? American interference, heat, pricing, and the chaos of the venues, the end of so many legendary legacies, Messi, Ronaldo, Modric, Neymar. Does it have that same summer of 94 feel that Alexi Lalas, no more please Fox, referenced so many times? I'm very interested to hear your takes. Also want to say, as always, thank you for making this an unforgettable experience. Hearing about your takes on the tournament day after day and providing us with the most content possible. Whilst I tried to watch every match, you guys made sure every gap was filled, up the ranks, and have the best week. I mean, this is really interesting. Thank you, Ethan, first and foremost. But also, what is the legacy of this tournament? I think both in the States and generally, because I think it has, on pitch, been mostly a brilliant tournament. We've had some incredible narratives. We've had stars shining and then a collective coming through to kind of undermine them all by winning the tournament in some ways. We've had chaos off the pitch at times. We've had very expensive tickets, but full venues and loud venues and good support in games. What do you think the legacy of this tournament will be?
I think the excellence prevailed in terms of an individual basis and on a team basis in the end. So I think that is a huge positive to see superstars turn up to a tournament and actually perform. Because I think if you're ever going to do that, it's important that you do it in America because they, you know, they support individuals as well as teams. And I think that in terms of for growing the sport, you know, they latch on to Haaland, for example. Like, this was huge for him, just to single him out. Like, individually, like, he is now, his profile was doubled from where it was. But the fact they were also able to see so many other players at their best, see Messi get all the way through to a final, I think that was extremely important. I think that there was also a sense of perspective from the American audience that is usually an audience that is win at all costs, right? America win at all costs. Like, if they're gonna enter a tournament, they want fair rules, but they also want their team to compete right to the end, and they want justice if anything goes wrong along the way. And with the Balogun red card, which is forever going to be spoken about over here in America, yes, they got justice because Balogun shouldn't have got a red card. But as soon as they learned that the only reason the red card was overturned was because of politics and because their president got involved, almost nobody was okay with it. And I think that was something really important to come out of this as well, and a big lesson for them to understand about what's accepted as okay and not. And I think that the backlash from the rest of the world was also something they actually mostly liked. I think that they were quite keen to see that they were shot down for that moment because it wasn't considered to be fair, and that's not what you do. Europeans tend to accept decisions even if they're not fair, and I think that's something that came into the tournament as well. I think it'll be remembered as a brilliant tournament overall, mate. I don't think there was enough negativity. The ticket pricing in America is always crazy no matter what you're going to see, so that's not something that's going to really stick around over here. It will do in Europe. Like, everyone in the rest of the world will talk about the ticket pricing forever and a day, and so they should, but over here that won't really be the talking point. In fact, anyone I know that has spent thousands on a ticket actually thinks it was worth every penny, which absolutely blows my mind. But there you go.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think the funny thing about that is the people who can afford to go are always going to be pleased that they were able to, you know, that they were afforded to go and that they got to go and witness a brilliant World Cup on the pitch. I think that what we will learn from the legacy is how much people enjoyed it over the next couple of years. Obviously, in 94, you know, I wasn't around and about, or I'd just been born. So the chances are that I wasn't able to kind of understand what that meant. But talking to people who were there, and Tommy Smith said this to me earlier, he said, you know, bear in mind, MLS didn't really catch the bandwagon at the time. There was another 2 years before MLS really got up and running and kind of was able to catch the tail end of the excitement from what that tournament had brought. And, you know, by that time, quite a lot of the excitement had died down. And I think that it's interesting to see how things react now. And look, whilst I don't, I love MLS because I think it's fun and chaotic, right? And I appreciate that not everyone is going to be like, oh, that's a kind of style of football I can watch to the same degree. And that's totally fair enough. But I think what also people would have experienced is the thrill of kind of going to a game in the pub with your friends and it being on all the bars. And maybe we'll see more people picking a European team and getting involved from that perspective. And also the thrill of being part of a crowd together. Now, I think this is the thing, you know, we talk about fan bases winning hearts and minds, and you can talk about the Scots in Boston or the Norwegians, wherever they went, or the Dutch down in Houston. It didn't really matter who it was. The point being that if people got involved with those marches and, you know, getting to the stadium, the culture around it, everyone going for a beer and having a good time, then you can see that with sports teams near you as well. Now, whether that transfers over from other sports teams and into other sports, question mark, right? But like, there are brilliant franchises around MLS. And I was talking to Ben Olsen, the head coach of Houston Dynamo earlier. And one of the things he said was, well, I can't do anything about it. I'm the head coach, right? What I can do is try and put the best possible product on the pitch so that people are looking at it and going, yeah, you know what? I want to go and see that in the same way that I wanted to watch the World Cup games on the TV or in the stadium, wherever it was. All I can do is my best to improve the product that's going out in front of those fans so that more people want to be involved, which is what I've been doing anyway. But whether there is that kind of catch on that MLS has, you know, begun pretty much off the back of the tournament, or, you know, a couple of days beforehand in some regards, if people start thinking, well, I might go to a game, there's one available, the kids are off for the summer, etc., they've got a bit of the bug, maybe we can take them somewhere close, a USL game, an NWSL game, whatever it is, that's, I think, where we're going to find the interest, or like, we're going to find out quite quickly whether there is a lasting impression made on people, or if, as was discussed on the Patreon in some of the comments, this feels more like the Olympics, where everyone gets really into it every 4 years and then doesn't think about, I don't know, figure skating for the next 4 years after that. We're about to find out, I think.
Yeah, we're about to find out. I mean, I'll be honest, I don't think this will seep that heavily into MLS. And MLS obviously tried to kind of, they've tried to buy into it. There's this advert over here that says, thank you, world, we'll take it from here. And then they played a couple of games last week when the tournament went quiet for a day. They played a couple of games. One of them was Galaxy against LAFC. I only saw the game the day after. I didn't even know it was on the day. And I'm someone that's like in that world constantly, and I still missed it.
In the region as well.
Yeah, and I'm in the region. And I absolutely, we would have watched that as a family because we're genuinely interested in it. And we missed it, so that didn't work. We're going to San Diego FC against Dallas at the weekend. Far from sold out. You know, clubs should be lowering ticket prices for these games and just being like $20 to get you through the door, as far as I'm concerned. But they're not, mate. Like, it's... I looked at next to us in the standing supporters section, there's this little seated area. It's Taylor's birthday at the weekend, so she wants people to come to the game. I was like, oh, maybe your friends could like go there because then you're kind of close to the noise, but they actually get to sit down and they can just kind of be part of it. $85 a ticket. What are you talking about? What are you talking about? So that sort of thing is just doesn't help the growth of the game, unfortunately. And so, I don't know, send this podcast to some friends that have enjoyed the World Cup for the first time. We'll try and get into it ourselves.
Yeah, I mean, look, I've banged that drum that, you know, doesn't necessarily fly, you know, here or in the US. This is not a US-specific problem whatsoever. But, like, I should have just given 1,000 tickets at every game of this World Cup to local schools. Like 1,000 tickets to Lord Christmas.
100% should have done that.
And it would have changed, you know, thousands of kids' lives in terms of being interested in the
game.
And
local, for all local football teams, anything like that. Yeah.
People who's already in, yeah, already through the door. You've already done the gateway and kind of used that to inspire. But hey, I don't have the bandwidth or the kind of leverage to be able to push these things through. Although I will stand for FIFA president if I get enough nominations.
You have a podcast, you're on Sirius. You're not doing too bad.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be between me and Shakira as the nomination for the next FIFA president. And if they give it to Shakira, I think that's totally fair enough as well. But we'll see. All right, let's just do a couple more bits. Nathaniel Leader says, might be a full episode on this at some point, but who do you think you guys think were the biggest winners and losers of this tournament? Whether that's individual players boosting their careers, veterans who either got it still or lost it, nations that over/underperformed, or federations on the whole who've showed a rise or a fall on the global stage. Hope you guys had a great time during the World Cup. Looking forward to see the season starting in a month's time up the ranks. And Connor said something very similar. He said, I'd love to hear your quick thoughts on the biggest winners and the biggest losers from the tournament player wise. Need some rogue shouts as well, not just the big names. So look, well, I think we can wrap this into a more general discussion in terms of what it was. I think this has been a good tournament for CAF without being a great tournament. I think it's been a bad tournament for CONMEBOL without being a dreadful tournament. They did have a team in the final when it came to it. I think it's been a good tournament. Three of the four teams in the semi-finals from UEFA, they had a pretty much a monopoly on the quarters as well.
UEFA not so much.
Asia have really struggled. I think the Asian Federation had a lot of high hopes for this tournament. And, you know, they were unfortunate in some regards, like Japan running into Brazil in the first game of the knockouts.
That's true. Actually, they played quite well and should have won, yeah.
Yeah, the Australia, I thought, handled themselves nicely and were a little bit unlucky to get knocked out on penalties. Like, there were some storylines there that maybe don't tell the full picture. But I do think it's been a good tournament for the African Federation. I think they'll be pleased to have got, what was it, 9 out of the 10 teams out of the group stages, even if none of them won a group. I think that there is some really bright, bright lights in the kind of African sphere right now. And I'm very excited. I think that Cote d'Ivoire are going to be a force to be reckoned with in a couple of years. I've banged this drum a bit, but this is such a talented young team, and they've used this tournament to blood youngsters to get them into the cycle. They've got World Cup experience, a World Cup knockout win under their belts now. I'm very, very excited to see where they go next.
Yeah, I think that's a good shout. Look, in terms of managers, there's some managers that have had bad tournaments. Nagelsmann had a mare, basically, didn't he, for Germany. He's got through to the last 32, and then ultimately he's exited the tournament in a penalty shootout defeat to Paraguay, and then he's lost his job. This was a massive tournament for him and Germany, and I think he's a massive loser from the tournament itself. But I'd say Roberto Martinez might outdo it, mate. That's two golden generations he's blown now. First was Belgium, now it's Portugal. Like, the guy's had some big jobs and he's not fulfilling what anyone needs. And I don't...
He must be the world's best interview.
Oh, he must be unbelievable at, like, PowerPoints.
They used to say this about Andre Villas-Boas, right? He's a man with the most unbelievable ideas, but then he'd get in and like they just wouldn't be able to execute them. And it feels very similar to Roberto Martinez.
Yeah, like Martinez, like you hear Martinez talk about football, he obviously knows his stuff, but like, I just don't know what level you'll end up at, like from here.
Next US manager, mate.
Could easily be something like that. You never know. But yeah, Portugal flat to deceive. And ultimately, he's done for Ronaldo's career as well, which doesn't help. So yeah, I'd say he's a loser. And the other thing that jumps out at me was I just think of Turkey. I just think in Turkey just absolutely flopped. I really thought that they could win their group. And you know, their only win of the group was the last kick of the game against USA's B team. Terrible tournament for them, and really disappointing for a nation that was so, so amped for this and were just completely let down.
Yeah, no, I agree. One of the things I think is interesting about Nagelsmann is still only 38 years old. Like he was such a baby coming into the coaching environment. I think he let himself down at this tournament. I think some of the decisions beforehand, calling back Manuel Neuer live on TV and not kind of letting Oliver Baumann know who'd been his number one before that, I think would have undermined his credibility. Talking about Leon Goretzka coming back in and being the glue in the dressing room when he hadn't played international football for like a year and a half, weird. And also he effectively brought back in all the players from Bayern who had undermined him when he was at Bayern. And he was like, oh, I need all those lads. I need those lads. Otherwise, not be able to do this. Weird. Whole thing was really odd. I hope that Julian Nagelsmann takes 6 months out. I think there is still a brilliant coach in there. I'm really excited to see how he starts to rebuild. I think it'll be outside of Germany where he goes next. And I still think that he, as an ideas man, some of the execution, what we saw at Euro 2024, where I think that Germany were, if not the best side in the competition, then definitely second to Spain. Like, there is definitely something there, but I just need to see a little bit more consistency from Nagelsmann. And I think he blew it up in his own face in this one. And there's a bit of soul searching going on in Germany, see what happens next. Obviously, they're in deep talks with Klopp to see if he will be the next man. There's a couple of sticking points with the RB job. But if he comes back in there, then that's going to be an intriguing element as well, because Germany feel in a difficult place. This could be the end of the road also for Marcelo Bielsa. That Uruguay performance was diabolical for such a proud footballing country who, you know, love the game so much and love World Cups more than anything on earth. Like, for him to have exited in that manner, I think is deeply, deeply disappointing. And yes, there were worries about Uruguay coming into the tournament. I don't think anyone thought they'd be quite as bad as this. And I do wonder if that's the last we see of Bielsa on a top stage in football. Like, I wonder if he has just burnt himself to a crisp.
Blimey. I think quite unimpressive. So that's definitely something to consider for this list. Trying to think if there's anyone else that jumps out at me. Don't think so.
No. I think what's interesting, it's been a really good tournament for Real Madrid players, right? Cucurella's had a brilliant tournament. Mbappe's had a brilliant tournament. Bellingham's had a brilliant tournament. Vinicius Jr. was excellent.
You can't count Cucurella as a Real Madrid player. He played for him, yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, that's what I mean. Going into this next season, they got a load of players who've had really good World Cups. Yeah. And yet, you know, all of them have one way or another fallen to the wayside of a Spain team, which is effectively based in Barcelona core, who are a collective unit, as this Spain side are, more than a bunch of individuals. And I wonder if, you know, sometimes we talk about World Cups and I always bring up the comparison from the 80s where that very defensive Italy side beat out Socrates' Brazil, right? And then we saw this decade of defensive football that kind of came off the back of it. I do wonder, with PSG winning back-to-back Champions Leagues under Luis Enrique and that collectivism of them, plus this Spain side where the team was the star rather than an individual player winning the World Cup, if we see a shift in footballing philosophy over the next couple of years with players buying more into the idea that actually they've got to get into this collective spirit, they've got to come into a generalization rather than relying on one or two individual stars to provide all of the wonder. Mm. And I find it really interesting to see how that shakes out when we kind of get into this next period of what club football will bring and then international football that follows that.
Yeah, exactly. I can't wait for La Liga, to be honest, mate. I think it's going to be a brilliant battle next season. I think that the levels are going up. There's so many storylines that are already opening up for that season. So I think that, you know, La Liga's been in like Premier League shadows for a little while now, and it feels like with drama, but also with quality of the league, we're starting to get back to where it was a few years back.
Credit to Javier Tebas and the salary cap, because they are bringing through an absurd amount of talented young Spanish players who are in all of these teams and have turned them into world winners again. Turns out it might not have been the worst idea of all after all. So yeah, a reluctant shout out to Javier Tebas. Right, Valdemar Isaksson said, can we hear your team of the tournament? I've got one for you, Dean, if you want. I can throw this at you and see where we go from there. Okay. So in goal, it feels weird not to put Unai Simon in here. But Unai Simon made 10 saves over the whole tournament. Like, that doesn't feel like...
I think he's not the goalie of the tournament.
I'm going to go with Paraguay's Orlando Gil.
Okay.
I think he was brilliant.
Yeah. He actually got the... he was the best rated goalkeeper at the tournament.
He made the most saves.
Yeah. He genuinely is like classed as the goalkeeper that genuinely did do the best. Don't know if I would necessarily pick him. I think I would have to get a Cape Verde player in here, mate.
I've already got two.
This is the only one I want. Vizinha has to make it. An unemployed goalkeeper. Get him in.
All right. I'm 40 okay with
years old, mate. He was unbelievable. He was unbelievable.
I think he was actually very, very good in certain bits of it. I did think in the Spain game, it was actually a defensive wall in front of him that did the majority of the work, but he did have some wonderful games.
Yeah, the Argentina game, well. He was unbelievable.
The Argentina game, he was great.
Just for that alone, I'm like, this guy's got to be out there. If you're playing an all-star game, like, he's the goalie.
Okay, all right, I'm okay with that. Honourable mention also to Gregor Kobel of Switzerland, who I thought was brilliant. But we
move on. Martinez probably deserves a shout, but yeah.
That's not a sexy enough name, so we can't have Gregor Kobel. So we'll have 20 million followers on Instagram, Vizinha, instead in there. Right back, I've gone Pedro Porro.
100%.
Right centre back, I've gone Parker Barsi. Left centre back, I've gone Pico Lopez.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of people going for Romero as the other centre back.
Well, I think Lisandro Martinez deserves a conversation in there as well. I think Lisandro was actually excellent for much of this tournament, but yeah. I'm still giving it to Pico Lopez, and I'm putting my foot down here. I thought he was brilliant, and he has to go in. And then a left back, I did originally have Sidney Lopes Cabral, the Cap Verde left back, but I think it might have to go to Mark Cucurella.
Cucurella has pipped him, hasn't he? Yeah, I don't think there's any doubt about three of those four, and then the other ones up for grabs. So I'll let your wisdom shine through there, seeing as you did actually watch every game.
Pico Lopes is going in there in the middle. The man from Crumlin, the Shamrock Rovers man, squeezes into the team of the tournament.
So what are you doing in front of them? Is it a 3-3 or like a 2-3-1?
2-3-1, I think.
Okay.
2-3-1. At the base of it, I've got Rodri and Bellingham.
Yep.
In the 10, I've got Michael Olise.
Yep.
On the left, I've squeezed in Mbappe. I know it's not really where he played, but feels you've right.
Got, it's the only way you get Messi and Haaland in, right?
Then I got Messi and Haaland in.
It's the only way you can do
boring,
it.
But like, it is actually, like, they all were unbelievable. Like, to leave out one of Bellingham, Olise, Messi, Mbappe, Haaland. Olise broke Pele's assist record, although he did also break the record for the most amount of shots without a goal at a World Cup. And it does make me laugh that the closest he came was the hardest chance where he flicked it up to himself and tried a bicycle kick on the edge of the box and hit the post. That was the closest he came. But if you break Pele's single assist record in a tournament, I think you probably have to go in. I think Messi was probably player of the tournament up to the final. And if he'd done a little bit more in the final, even if they'd lost 2-1 and he'd scored, I think he would have won the golden ball. So it feels weird not to put him in. I think Mbappe is now the all-time leading goal scorer and the golden boot winner. And everyone's fallen in love with Erling Haaland. So I'm not sure how else you'd squeeze anyone else in, if I'm honest.
No, look. Enzo Fernandez would put forward a case. I mean, look, he scored that goal against Egypt. Then he scored the goal against England. And he was kind of like the centerpiece of like their like rousing, raging, all action team, right? But there's just no way you can make it after what happened in the final.
You can't get sent off in the final and then still be there, man. Unfortunately, that's it. So... yeah, like I think Lisandro is probably the one that I'd be like, he's a little bit unlucky to miss out.
I think that one centre back spot would need closer analysis to completely uncover.
It's going to Pico Lopez. I'm sorry. I'm afraid there's no conversation here. Like Pico Lopez is getting in here. As an Irish born man in the World Cup team of the tournament, this is as close as we've got to it, right? He's going in the team. So there we are. My foot's going down on that one. But yeah, I think that has to be the team of the tournament. And, you know, it feels a bit weird to just put the kind of big names in at the top. But I think Johan Manzambi is a little bit unlucky to miss out on that. I think Manzambi was excellent, but you know, these are players who have broken records left, right, and center. So unfortunately, they're all in there. Well, I think that would do us here on Ranks FC. There is a little bit more to this episode. One of our ultras, Freddie, has gone out to Costa Rica and given us his experiences of a life-changing World Cup seen through the eyes of someone in Costa Rica for it, which is well worth your time. But a reminder that this is what we do on Ranks week in, week out over the course of the season. These post boxes where we answer all of your questions about the Premier League, European football, transfers, etc., all the way through the season. We'll be getting into some transfer Q&As over on the Patreon as well in the next couple of weeks with Dean. So we'd love to have you over there. The link is in the description as ever. It would be a delight off the back of this World Cup for you to come and join us over on our Patreon as we get towards very, very quickly, maybe too quickly, towards another season rolling in. But plenty to come over there as well. There'll be plenty to come on this feed for its worth as well. We've got some special guests lined up to talk about a variety of different things, and there'll be some transfer specials coming here as well. But for now, all that's left for me to do is say a massive thank you to Mr. Dean Jones.
Cheers, mate.
I've been Jack Collins. This has been Ranks FC and our special post box taken over from our Patreon. We'd love you to come and join us, as we say. But if not, we'll see you later in the week, Rank Squad, here on the main feed as well. We'll see you all very shortly. Take it easy. Peace.